Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, and I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and our online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce John Minderman here today. John is the author of In Pursuit, From the Streets of San Francisco to Watergate. Great story about how a San Francisco policeman was recruited into the FBI, and one of his first assignments was to check out a very small burglary at the Watergate Hotel. So, John.
Thank you to each one of you for coming this evening. I greatly appreciate your attendance and your interest in this subject matter. I'd like to also thank my co-writer, Brian Solon, in the rear there. Brian, who did a great job working on the book with me. And next to him, Bill Upson, who really was the catalyst for getting started. Bill, thank you very much. Brian. And, of course, George and the Commonwealth Club for extending the invitation to have the privilege to offer what I experienced in the Watergate case and kind of a brief snippet of the prelude to that, which was my experience in the San Francisco Police Department, which in many ways prepared me for my career in the FBI, the experiences that I had here in an 8.5-year career with the police department. I really hadn't planned to become involved with the police or the FBI, but I found myself approaching the end of a really enjoyable college experience at San Francisco State, and I needed to find a job. I had to do something, and so I figured, maybe I could work as a police officer somewhere, and that would probably be adventuresome, stimulating, and interesting for a while, and the pay isn't bad, and the benefits, and I bet there's a lot of interesting things that happen to police officers. So I signed up, took the exam, and I passed, and I became a San Francisco police officer after about 3 months training. My first assignment was not too far from here. It was Northern Police Station. It was on Ellis Street near Polk. Worked 4 to 12 one week, midnight to 8 the next. So you were constantly changing back and forth, and your days rotated. So my first insight was, working as a San Francisco police officer with those hours, you were constantly fatigued. If at any time you question the judgment or the decision or the results of a police officer or the action he or she might take, remember this. That officer is most probably very tired when that decision is made. The second thing that comes along, as I recall what I did with the police, you have very, very little time to make any decision. Events come at you quickly. You make a decision. As you make the decision to take an action or advise somebody or move on, other things are happening within the same set that you're faced with, and you have to make another decision and another move. So it's constantly observe, assess, take action, get ready to observe again. You're very much like a fighter pilot, one-on-one in the air, trying to figure out what move you're going to make. Amidst the fatigue, the limited information, sometimes outright lies. So if you combine that, you have a difficult area in which to make a decision. What I'd like to share with you are a few of the stories that I actually experienced as I worked in the police department. As I went out on the streets actually to do the policing, our method of communication that they gave us was this brass key. You got a brass key and you got a whistle. And you went out the front door and you were assigned a beat. They said, walk it and take the proper police action. Never explained quite what the proper police action was. But believe me, if it didn't work out really well, you took the improper action. So you had a lot of latitude. You had a lot of discretion, and you had virtually no supervision. Police officers have an amazing amount of latitude in what they do, in the support they have, not, and what they must do to move forward quickly. I'm amazed at what the officers today have in the way of communications gear and how it must aid in what they do and help them overall. We were limited, and we did the best with what we could. This key fits the blue boxes, which are still affixed to telephone poles, utility poles, some standing free. As you go around San Francisco, you'll see them. They're deactivated now. The cops don't use them. They gave you the key, and they said it fits the blue boxes and call in if you need help. But they didn't give you a map as to where the blue boxes were. You had to find the blue boxes. That first night when I actually walked a beat on the midnight, up Lark and I went toward Geary. I figured probably I really need to check the bars out. That's what an officer does. He walks in the bars that are open, and he may talk to the bartender or the owner, kind of size up the situation and move on. So the first bar I came to, still up there, the gangway, just off Geary. Walked into the gangway. Very crowded and very limited in front. As I walked in, there was a woman and two men standing alongside one another at the bar, but facing out, not facing in toward the bar. So when I walked through that front door, there were people behind me here, and I actually had to kind of squeeze between everyone. And as I went by the woman, I thought I heard her say, "It's a gun." But as I was sliding by her, and I thought I heard that in the low voice, my reaction was, as I was sliding in front of the first man, "That's crazy. Why would she say that? Did she say that? Did I hear that? It's a gun." Now I'm face to face with the first man. I'm by her. So I'm looking directly at him, blank facial expression, and as I'm about ready to go by him, it clicks. I heard that. She said, "It's a gun." Where would the gun be? It's not going to be up here. It's going to be down in the waistband. So I started sliding my eyes down, and what I saw was this. I saw a hand inside a jacket sliding across the abdomen horizontally. I immediately slapped my hand over his and slid it down in front of his, and I felt the large rectangular butt of what turned out to be a .45 caliber, fully loaded, semi-automatic pistol cocked. Cocked. So I removed that gun. Now I had to take the proper police action. What is that? Well, I commanded everybody to stand back. I grabbed the individual with the gun very forcefully right here. And with one hand, I turned him around and I pushed him over the bar. I took the gun and I slid it down the bar toward the bartender. I said, "Put your hand over this and keep control of it." I cuffed up the individual who I took the gun off of and told the bartender, "Call the police, tell them it's not an emergency, but that I need help quickly, very quickly." It turned out that particular man with that gun, who was in the process of drawing it when I walked in and by him, was on parole from San Quentin for manslaughter. He had already killed somebody. So I presume that he was not going to hold the place up when I walked by. He was going to do something else, and I surmise he probably was going to start shooting at me when I was toward the end of the bar. He had no other reason to take that gun out. So that was my first encounter as a police officer. But there were many, many more that I had during the course of my experience with SFPD. It was a marvelous experience. I worked with a great number of different officers who brought a lot to the table And I was very, very fortunate to have them train me, to mentor me, and to help me, sometimes in some very, very difficult situations. I'd like to share one more brief story with you, which kind of defines the times in San Francisco during that period. It was a different time. We're coming out of this period where corruption, payoffs, were part of the fabric of San Francisco. It goes back to the Barbary Coast. It goes back to corruption from 1911, 1912, the big scandal they had then with Abe Roof. There were all kinds of things going on. So it's easy to criticize the police officers, but keep in mind the police officers are part of the fabric of the city. They were all local boys. You had to be a resident here for at least 5 years to sign up to take the police test. And after you took the police test, if you're an officer, you had to live in the city while you practiced policing. Came to work one day at Mission Station. Lieutenant said, "Minderman, you got the one car?" I said, "Yes, sir, I do." He said, "Well, go up to the expansion. They've got a case for us." Well, I suspected this was a case for consumption, not a case to investigate. So I went up to the expansion, which was a bar in the area I was assigned. I walked in. I said, "The lieutenant sent me up. He said, you've got a case for us." He plopped a case of whiskey on top of the bar. Full uniform. I picked up that case of whiskey, marched back to the radio car, double parked on Market Street, all the red lights going, all the yellow lights going. Market Street. Opened the trunk, put the 12 bottles in, back to Mission Station. Into the station I went. Lieutenant wasn't in his office, so I quickly slid that case of 12 underneath his desk, out of the sight of the other officers, because I was afraid an officer might take a bottle or two in the lieutenant's absence. Back out on the street, I went in service. Very, very embarrassed that I had to do this. I didn't want any part of this. It wasn't part of what I liked to do. Back in the street, in service, an ominous call comes over the radio. "Mission 1, return to the station. See the lieutenant." A bottle or two is missing. Back to the station I went, into his office. He was sitting on high, white shirt, gold bars. He looked like his blood pressure was probably in excess of 180, obviously very upset. He pointed to the offending case of liquor. "Did you bring that crap in here?" I said, "Yes, sir, I did." "You take it back, and you tell him that we don't drink that crap." "You want me to tell him in those words, Lieutenant?" "Absolutely. You tell him what I said." Into the car. Into the police car. Went the 12. All the way back up to Market Street I went. Now, the patrons in the expansion had undoubtedly seen an officer or two from San Francisco carrying whiskey out. No one had ever seen a cop carrying whiskey in. But that was me carrying the whiskey back in. Up onto the bar, I plopped the whiskey. The owner looked very confused. I was a bit angry and very frustrated. I said, "Look, I'm only the messenger boy here. Only the messenger boy. I'm going to tell you what the lieutenant told me to tell you. Are you ready?" "I guess so." "He told me to tell you that we don't drink this crap." He actually said that?" "So that's exactly what he said." "Well, what does he want?" I said, "Well, can you give me something a little bit better?" Now, in the FBI, I was trained as a hostage negotiator. This was the beginning of that experience in negotiation right here in San Francisco. Okay? I did a lot of it. "How about early times?" What we had was Four Roses, which I gather was kind of a lower-end blended whiskey. Okay? Very offensive to the lieutenant. Very offensive. Okay? "How about early times?" I said, "Is that better?" He said, "Well, a little bit." I said, "Let's try." So We went in, I carried that whiskey back into Lieutenant, I plopped it down, hoping that might do the job, and he smiled as though I really had performed outstanding police work. Now, when I got the assignment, it was the collaborative, they've got a case for us, okay? The collaborative us, I'm involved here. Now, that was in the acquisition phase. In the distribution phase, us was not part of the equation, okay? I share that with you, and I gather it kind of hits a chord with some of you, okay? Yeah, it does. But that was the tenor of the police department in those days. I want to share one last story because it has a lot of lessons in it. A lot of lessons in it. Then we get on to Watergate. I'm working at midnight. It's Christmas morning. That is the quietest midnight you'll ever experience. There is nothing going on. Just Santa and the sleigh, I guess, upstairs are. That's it. My partner was Denny. Denny passed number one on the police list. Denny was a smart guy. Denny and I headed out for our quietest midnight watch. We stopped at a bar, entered the bar. Denny confidently ordered a traveler. A traveler. I never heard a traveler. The bartender took care of the order. The traveler turned out to be a 12-ounce Coke bottle filled with bourbon and a slight splash of water with a bourbon cork in the top. That traveler fit perfectly inside your cloth patrol jacket. Okay? We exited with Denny and his traveler and John riding. Around we went for the whole 6 to 7 hours with nothing happening. Occasionally, Denny would take a nip from the traveler as we patrolled. And this went on until about 6:15 or 6:20 in the morning. Just killing time, wanting to get the end here. The radio came alive. And all units broadcast. All units. We have a 211 at the Travel Lodge, Valencian Market. 211's in armed robbery. Denny and I sprinted to the radio car. Down Valencia Street, we went toward Market. Red lights on, stealth mode, no siren. We wanted to arrive quietly. En route down there, Denny had another nip on the traveler. Denny said to me, handed me a key. He said, unlock the shotgun. Take the shotgun out, John. I said, Denny, by the time we get there, it's going to be all over. John, I told you, get the shotgun out. Get it ready. Okay, I get the shotgun out. Action. Got the gun. Denny goes in. Robbery's completely over. I've got the shotgun. I'm not doing anything. I'm just standing there where Denny's interviewing the clerk about what happened. Clerk describes the gun as a large gun. Very large gun. Much bigger than R-38s. So it's a 45 with a 6-inch barrel revolver. Unusual gun. I decide I better do something just so it looks like I am taking the proper police action. So I exit, and I begin wandering around the parking lot, and there's three cars parked over against the brick wall. Got the shotgun. So I go by the cars, take a look, not hiding behind the cars, walk by the cars, stand with my back to the cars with the shotgun. And for a while, I'm just kind of looking out the rest of the lot to see if I see anybody running or doing anything. And I come back, and I decide as I go by these three cars, I'll give it another look. And this time, instead of just looking over the top of the front fender from the rear, I stood on my tiptoes, giving me another 2 or 3 inches. The third car, what do I see? Top of a head. It's him. It's the hold-up man with the gun. Not the shotgun. I level a shotgun across the car. There's nobody around. There's just me, my key, my shotgun, and my whistle. There's no pick radio. And the parking lot. Not even Santa's around, or the dwarves, or the horse, or any of that stuff. The reindeer. I level a shotgun, and in a quaking voice, I say, stand up. Put your hands up. Hands come up, and he's saying, don't shoot. don't shoot. And I'm saying, keep your hands up, keep your hands up. So we're going back and forth. Don't shoot, don't shoot. Keep your hands up, keep your hands up. Get the whistle out as I hold the shotgun. Blow the whistle. That communication device worked. Then he came running out. We cuffed up the individual, took him into custody. He had the fully loaded .45 revolver in his cowboy boot, and he had 22 rounds of loose ammunition on his person. As we loaded him into the patrol wagon, I stopped him. I grabbed him by the arm, and I says, hey, I walked by you. I looked over the top of the car. I didn't see you. I walked right by you. I stood with my back to you for quite a while. I said, why didn't you shoot me? He looked at me and he said, things might have been different if it wasn't for the shotgun. Thanks, Denny. So you can see, even though I wasn't drinking, whose judgment was better? Yeah, whose judgment was better? So when you made judgments in the police department about things, you had to be very, very cautious. Things would happen, and you had to be a little bit cautious in how you evaluated them and where you put yourself and what you did. I enjoyed my time, but it wasn't going to be the end all. So I entered the FBI, and I wound up in Washington, D.C., after a short stint in Texas. Now, that was adjustment, but I won't get into that. We'll go back to Washington. And I was in Washington about 3 years. I had the weekend duty. You got the weekend duty about once every 6 or 7 months. There were so many agents there. I had the weekend duty the weekend of June 16th to 18th. I was on call. And that was when the burglary occurred on the Watergate. I was in the shower that Saturday morning and quite annoyed when the phone rang. And it turned out I was dispatched to come in and to interview individuals who had been apprehended in the Democratic National Headquarters of the Watergate complex, 4 Cuban nationals and 1 individual who was a former FBI agent and a former CIA agent. We scrambled a team to come in on that particular Saturday morning. There was myself, Angelo Leno, and about 5 or 6 other agents. And it moved very, very quickly. My end of the investigation turned out to be the money trail. I began the investigation on the money trail and stayed with the money trail through the whole case. But what I'd like to mention to you are some of the actual quirky things that happened with the Watergate case from the FBI perspective, not from All the President's Men or the great movie by the same name. You've all read a lot of books about the Watergate. But what you haven't read about is what the FBI did, what we experienced as agents in investigating the case. And that's the part I want to get to and share with you. You might wonder how the police were so efficient in apprehending the burglars within the Watergate complex, committing the burglary with the evidence on them or immediately in their close proximity. That's rare to happen in any kind of police work, that you get the bad guys in the place with the evidence on them. Usually they're gone in the hallway, running, throwing the stuff away. So it's a partial victory if you catch anybody. Here's what happened. Friday night, the call comes in from the security officer at the Watergate. Suspicious occurrence, tape on a door. Cops acknowledge the call. They dispatch a marked radio car with 2 uniformed officers, Metropolitan Police. It's Friday night. The 2nd District Headquarters, where these police operate from, is rocking and rolling. It's the nightclub area on a Friday night in Georgetown on M Street and Wisconsin. So the police are besieged with calls about what's going on in the nightclub area with people celebrating, drinking, having a good time. So the uniformed cops are pretty much tied up. They finally get 2 cops to respond. En route to handle the burglary, the following radio transmission occurred. Unit XYZ to headquarters. Go ahead, XYZ. We've had a mechanical breakdown. We can't respond to the Watergate. In a somewhat suspicious tone, communications comes back and says, what's the nature of the mechanical breakdown? There's a hesitation. We ran out of gas. The uniformed officers ran out of gas and couldn't respond. Now they had a scramble to get somebody to respond. All the MARC units are tied up. There was within 2D a specialized unit called the Scooter Squad. These were undercover officers dressed in all kinds of different regalia and clothing to blend into the scene, riding little motor scooters. Okay? So the sergeant in charge of the Scooter Squad is ready to go off with his men, and he hears the call, repeated call, any unit to respond, suspicious occurrence, the Watergate, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, the sergeant says, let's go. Jump on the scooters, respond to the Watergate. The lookout for the burglars across the street in the Howard Johnsons never made the cops. They pulled up on the scooters, ran in the building, went right up to the Democratic National Headquarters. There was no warning to the burglars. So when the non-uniformed cops, the Scooter Squad, hit it, they got them as dirty as you can get them. They got them all. They got them right inside, and they got them with the evidence either on their person or in a duffel bag immediately in the vicinity. And guess what we found in a duffel bag? A small microphone with a clip wrapped in toilet paper. That microphone was a federal violation, interception of communication. You don't have to show usage. The only thing you have to show is that it was not manufactured in the immediate area around where the burglary occurred. And in this case, there was no known manufacturing entity in the District of Columbia. So jurisdiction for the FBI was clear and unambiguous. That is huge, because unlike the local police, we don't enter a case or an investigation unless there's a federal interest. So there was the federal interest. So the first break, the cops ran out of gas. The second break, they had in the duffel bag that they were carrying in the burglary the microphone, which was clear evidence of a federal violation. Also in that duffel bag were Minolta cameras, film, all kinds of things. The money actually was found in some rooms in the Watergate complex. That complex that is up here on the thing that you saw before I began to talk here, that complex, Watergate complex, is multi-use. It's a hotel. It's also business offices. It's a lot of different things. It is huge. So the burglars had two rooms in the Watergate where they stayed overnight and got ready to do the burglary. They had on their person, when they were apprehended, room keys to their two rooms. So one of the things that happened was, of course, we put together an affidavit for a search warrant for those rooms. And in the rooms, of course, when we executed the search warrant, were found additional indications of what we needed in terms of evidence. There were consecutive numbered brand new $100 bills in a wallet on one of the beds in room 234. Brand new consecutive $100 bills. That was the beginning of the money trail. We took that money and began rather a convoluted trail to trace the money down. And that was one of the things that I did in this particular case, was trace that money down. And we reached a point where the money was in Mexico City. We had it to Mexico City. And our administrative case agent, the agent responsible for the overall running of the total Watergate investigation, was a very aggressive agent by the name of Angelo Leno. He was a terrific agent. There's a culture in the FBI that allows an agent to push back very hard, rather hard, against any other agent or even a supervisor or an assistant agent in charge, or even your boss, the special agent in charge, if you believe the decision about to be made is incorrect. You are encouraged to dissent and make your case. regardless of whether you're the newest guy or the oldest guy or regardless of your rank. In this particular case, we needed Bureau approval, FBI headquarters approval, to send a lead to cover the money trail in Mexico City. The agent in charge at the time, Robert Kunkel, read the teletype that Agent Leno had authored for headquarters, and it was simply too accusatory and too impolite. So he said, I can't sign this out. Angelo, I can't sign this out. Angelo was a relief supervisor, and as such, he had the authority to sign the special agent in charge's signature as long as he put his signature underneath it after drawing a line. He had that power as a relief supervisor, filling in for the normal supervisor. Leno beseeched the SAC to sign it out. Mr. Kunkel said, I'm not signing it out, Angelo. Angelo took the teletype, looked at the SAC, and said, watch this. Watch this. Put his initials underneath and went to the teletype room and sent it out. Gray, the acting director, got the teletype and went through the roof. Who had the temerity to send this out? Get him over here. Angelo marched over and faced the director. But the lead was covered. The lead was covered. That was part of our culture, and as I mentioned, a very healthy part of the culture. A lot of other things happened in the course of that investigation. And one of the things that happened early on in the investigation were leaks, a lot of leaks. And we were summoned to Bureau headquarters, the 27 of us responsible for the case, a week after the case, and we were read the Riot Act by then Acting Director Gray for leaking information to the press concerning the early parts of the Watergate case. So the finger was pointed at us. We were the guys, and it was demanded of us as we stood around this table, whoever leaked the information, take one step forward. Well, I wasn't moving. And as I looked right and left, I didn't see anybody else moving. Okay, so Gray, once again, went volcanic. I demand the agent or agents who leaked that information to Sandy Smith in Chicago take one step forward. He's grabbing the rostrum and shaking and turning red in the face. He's a former naval captain. You don't see me moving, and I don't see anybody else moving, except our special agent in charge, Mr. Kunkel, begins to take a step forward. I presume he was going to defend his agents. Gray looked at him. Did you leak the information, Mr. Kunkel? No, sir, I didn't. Well, then take one step back. There's your boss taking one step back. Okay, it ended with Gray going over the top and screaming, "If any of you agents ever appear before me again for anything, I will fire you. You're dismissed." And with that, he exited. Well, as we made our way up Pennsylvania Avenue back to our office, we were quite angry. We became more determined. That turned out to be a real pep talk, a real pep talk. As we worked the money trail, we put together a plan to interview all of the people who worked for the committee to reelect the president. The people who worked for the committee could only be interviewed on the premises with an attorney for CREEP present during the interview. But you can imagine we got yes and no answers or no answer at all. But we always left our card. We always said, if you remember anything, please give us a call. we got a call. We got a call from a woman named Peggy Gleason. Peggy worked for the security part of the committee. Peggy said, my friend Judy really wants to talk to you, but she's afraid. We managed to assuage the fears and set up an interview with Judy. She indicated she had a lot to tell, but she was a little bit uncomfortable with the setting, and she would possibly give us a call back. About five or six days later, she called my partner, Paul Magalinas, and she said, I'd like to talk some more. So we said, why don't we meet in a lounge at the Keybridge Marriott across the line on the Virginia side. So we met there, and we talked briefly with Peggy and with Judy. Judy Hoback was her name. Judy Hoback was the auditor, the accountant, the individual who dispersed the cash for CREEP. She had knowledge of all of the thousands of dollars and who they were paid to fund the burglary and other operations. After we talked with her for about 45 minutes in the lounge, she said she'd be more comfortable if we talked in her home. So we followed her to her home in Maryland, and Paul and I interviewed her for 8 hours, from 7 o'clock at night to about 3 in the morning. The statement that she gave us when we typed it up, was 19 single-space pages, 19, longest one I've ever done. It had in there all of the information, dates, times, amounts, as to cash monies that she was ordered to distribute to different burglars and two different individuals. It was our first linkage between the committee and the president's apparatus, and we took it from there. It was a key interview and a key piece of information. Judy Hoback was 31 years old. She had an 8-month-old infant, and her husband had died of a heart attack recently. So she was in need of a job. And what I want to convey to you is she stepped forward. She put herself at risk a lot of different ways, and she did the right thing. And the thing that I remember about dealing with different people in the FBI and dealing with different situations, this one in particular, Americans always do the right thing. They come forward. They know when it's wrong. They have a conscience, and they cooperate. And so we were very, very fortunate in this situation. There's a lot more we could cover. One of the things that I failed to mention to you, the pressure in the Watergate case came immediately. The first night, on that Friday night where the burglary occurred, our office, our Washington field office, the supervisor on duty, received a telephone call. The telephone call was from an individual who identified himself as John Ehrlichman. And the individual who identified himself as John Ehrlichman screamed into the telephone, shut the case down now. Supervisor said that wasn't going to happen. Ehrlichman repeated, or the voice repeated, I told you, shut the case down now. Well, obviously the case was not shut down. The FBI doesn't shut down the case. In fact, to the opposite, after we continued our investigation that first weekend, some of the other evidence we found, catch this one. Agents are searching the dresser drawer in room 243 where the burglar stayed overnight. Underneath the paper in one of the drawers is an envelope. On the envelope is an address, but the return address is for an E. Howard Hunt with an address in Potomac, Maryland. We check indices for E. Howard Hunt, and it turns out E. Howard Hunt is now associated with the committee to reelect the president. And he's a former CIA agent, a case manager for the CIA. In fact, when he applied to become a member of the president's entourage, the committee to reelect the president, we had to do a very deep background check on him. So we had a current file in detail about E. Howard Hunt. So the very day that we got involved in the burglary, through that envelope, we were able to identify and trace the manager for the burglary and knew everything about him. We were out at his home interviewing him the very same day the investigation commenced. He acknowledged the envelope was his, but he wouldn't say any more. So what we did, basically, was a blitz that first weekend. We covered every possible lead. We sewed it up as tightly as we could. We had jurisdiction established. We identified E. Howard Hunt. We identified who the burglars were, the four Cubans. Monday morning, when we were getting ready to roll in our office where we had the C2 squad. Oh, I failed to mention the name of the C2 squad, the one that I was on. I mean, we had a bank robbery squad. We had a fugitive squad. We had a kidnapping squad. We had all kinds of foreign counterintelligence squads chasing the Russians, chasing the Bulgarians, chasing everybody, okay? You know the name of my squad? Miscellaneous crimes. Miscellaneous crimes. But we were a proud bunch. We were the younger agents. We were the inexperienced agents. But we established ourselves sufficiently on that first weekend to not have the case taken away from us and given to more experienced agents. That first Monday morning in our office, where about 12 of us sat in an open area with those government gray steel desks and those spiffy chairs, there were agents from other squads, about 20 of them, standing against the wall, waiting for assignment. I had never seen this before in the FBI. I thought, wow, 20 additional bodies. They are really serious about this. It was on. It was really on. So that's where the case kind of took us. That was the beginning. One of the things that happened to us personally was we were accused of being the leakers. That, as a matter of fact, wasn't the case. We were not the leakers. We were just the workers. It turned out when everything came out in the wash, the leakers were actually the FBI executives and mid-managers at headquarters. They were the leakers. And there was more than one. There was more than one deep throat. Mark Felt was just one. There were several more. So what they were doing, apparently, was fingering us as the leaks while they kept the leaks going. And there may have been a reason for it, and I put it in the book. I think the reason for the leaks, of course, was to keep the case in and before the American public, so that the support was there for the investigation. And we were merely collateral damage in being fingered as the guys that were doing the leaks to protect themselves. Okay? So I think we could accept that. Probably took more than my time. Anyway, Q&A?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It is time for the Q&A, and I'd like to remind our audience online and the radio that they're listening to John Minderman at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco talking about his book, In Pursuit. He was on the FBI team that investigated at the Watergate Hotel for the break-in in 1970. When did it take place? In 72, right? When did the break-in take place? In 72,
yeah,
right, during the election?
It took place on the weekend of April 16th to 18th. It began on a Friday night. It went over into the morning hours of the 17th, the actual case. The break-in, the apprehension occurred late in the evening by the Metropolitan Police on the 16th. They then took the prisoners, and they were processing them. They immediately notified the FBI, and I forgot to mention one important thing here, and it's very, very critical. We had an excellent working relationship with the police department in Washington, D.C. And so with that close relationship, we got information from them immediately. And they were most cooperative. For instance, when the affidavit was written, search rooms 234 in the other room where the burglars were, when they got the keys off the burglars, the police did. It was actually the detectives that worked with the assistant United States attorney in crafting the affidavit to take before the magistrate to get the search warrant. So the police officers themselves were highly helpful and very, very skilled. So that working relationship that had been ongoing for a long time paid off in this particular case. It's not always the case when you work in the FBI that you have a great working relationship with local police officers. Sometimes it's not that way because we do investigations of police officials and police brutality and other things which are not necessarily going to endure you to the local police officers. But in this case, we had excellent working relations that paid off. Yeah.
One before the questions, one other thing, one other story I think everybody would love to hear, and that is you talked about in the book the working relationship with the Secret Service that ran the White House. I think you should tell that story because not many people have heard this one.
Yes. My wife has been diligently coaching me here as I tend to run over and around things and forget things. So she's been coaching me, and she does a great job, but unfortunately I'm not really very good at following orders, or guidance, for that matter. Okay, all right. What I forgot to mention, God, this is what I wanted to mention above all. Here's what happened. Here's how the thing came to a head. Secret Service. I'm glad you mentioned that, George. This one you are not going to believe, and this one, believe me, no one knows about. This hasn't been written about or wasn't in the movie or anything like that. And whoever wrote books about Watergate didn't write about this one. It's April 27th, a Friday. Beautiful day in the District of Columbia. Couldn't be nicer. Everybody's looking forward to going home. Getting close to 5 o'clock. Supervisor walks in and he says, "Freeze the book. Freeze the book. Nobody goes home." Means you can't sign out. There's a collective groan that goes up amongst the agents. Christ of Friday. How long do we have to sit here before they make up their minds? About 12 minutes later, supervisor comes in and he goes, you. Real personal. You over there. Okay. Go down to the SAC's office, special agent in charge. We had a new one now, Jack McDermott, New Yorker, Fordham Law School, Fordham University, outgoing, funny, had that great New York attitude. Loved to involve the agents in whatever was going on, personally involved the agents in what was going on. Go on down to the SAC's office, he wants to see you. Go down to the fifth floor. He's got a big office there in the old post office building. All old stuff because this building was built in 1899. It's on the loop. Come on in. Stand around the wall. So we're up against the wall. He's on the phone behind the desk. He's just radiating confidence. He's just enjoying himself. We have no idea what's going on. He says to his secretary, "Get me the Secret Service." Something's going on. Wait a while. The phone rings, and it's Millie on the other end. She apparently has a Secret Service. "You got the Secret Service for me, Millie?" "Good." "Hello. Is this the Secret Service headquarters?" "This is Jack McDermott, special agent in charge of the FBI Washington field office. Let me talk to whoever's in charge." "He's not available?" "Well, give me the number 2 man." "He's not available? Well, is anybody there in charge of the Secret Service?" His voice is rising now. He's not happy. I guess the guy on the other end of the line is scrambling around to find somebody in charge of the Secret Service on a Friday at 5:15 at Secret Service headquarters. Finally, somebody apparently gets on the line. Third man down, fourth man down, who knows? McDermott's still on the line. "Hello, are you in charge of the Secret Service?" "You are." "My name's Jack McDermott. I'm the special agent in charge of the Washington field office of the FBI. How are you?" "Good." Getting real personal now. "How are you?" Good. We're still standing around wondering what's going to happen. This is what we hear. And he is in prime mode. He is loving it. I'm not sure we're going to love it, but he is. "On orders of the Attorney General, there will be a dozen or so special agents of the FBI moving up Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. They will be entering the White House from the West Wing. They will be occupying and shutting down and securing all business offices of the president, including his personal business office. No, no, FBI agents will not be surrendering their guns to the Secret Service on entering the White House. And then he adds, FBI agents are always armed. They're not giving up their guns to the Secret Service, and they will be entering the White House and carrying out the Attorney General's order. I'm standing over here, and I'm going, I don't believe this, what I just heard. This is more than just freeze the book. No, that's all. Goodbye, slammo. So the last thing he says to the Secret Service is, we're not giving up our guns, and we're going in the White House. And he looks up. He's smiling. He's really happy. And he rotates his gaze, and he hits each one of us. And then he says, any questions, gentlemen? Any questions, gentlemen? Well, I've been in the FBI long enough to know. When that question is asked by a boss, there's never a question. Never a question, because the reason they hired you and you're a special agent working for them is you're smart enough to figure it out, whatever it is, and that's why they hired you. So don't ask any questions. Figure it out. On your way. So we walked out down to Pennsylvania Avenue. There's about a dozen of us, and we're walking up Pennsylvania Avenue toward the White House in silence. We have no leader. We have no plan. We have orders. Okay? Everybody else is scurrying around, going for buses. They're going to drive out of the district. They're going to have a good weekend. This is where we're headed. We get to about 13th Street, and I hear a voice. Comes from my left. Hey, Min. Me, Minderman. Hey, Min. Do you think they'll shoot? Well, why did the question come to me? Well, the question came to me because I had 8.5 years in San Francisco as a street cop. And I had pretty much, and they knew this, I had pretty much been involved in a lot of different situations that the law school students and the accountants and all these other guys who were military officers, they hadn't been involved in this stuff. I had. So they respected my judgment in matters like this, unpredictable matters, okay? Hey, man, do you think they'll shoot? Okay. Well, do I know any more than anybody else? Huh? The answer is no. But what's the answer I've got to give? What's the answer they want to hear? Huh? What's the answer you give? Oh, no, that's right. That's exactly right. No, the answer is the following. Here's the answer I gave. Oh, no. No, they're not going to shoot. Now I've got to really think and tell my biggest lies. No, no, they're not going to shoot. I said, you know, I've had a lot of experience with the Secret Service. Actually, some. I've had a lot of experience with the Secret Service, and they're professional, just like us. They're calm and they're focused. I said, they're not going to shoot. I had no idea whether there was going to be any shooting. I didn't know one thing, and this concerned me. If one gun went off, all guns go off. That's the danger. When you're dealing with more than one armed individual, whether they're police officers, FBI agents, or one gun goes off, more guns or all guns go off. So no, no, they're not going to shoot. Everything's going to go down just like we said. I said, we're going to go up there. We're going to take out our credentials. We're going to identify ourselves. They're going to see the big blue FBI. They'll know who we are. So we get up to the West Wing of the White House. Here's 12 guys with these little credentials. Huh? Approaching the White House, and behind there are the Secret Service. We don't know what orders they've got or what they're going to do or what Nixon told them to do. And we're going, FBI Special Agent, FBI, hi, Secret Service, FBI Special Agent. And I'm just hoping I don't hear a gun go off. Well, no guns went off. And we entered. We had the help and the guidance of the Secret Service. And we guarded and we occupied all business offices from that point forward so that no evidence, nothing could go out of those offices, and the president could not, himself even take items out, nor could he go in, okay? Here's what happened. He was at Camp David that weekend, and he was going up and down emotionally. He was depressive. He was paranoid. He stated to some people at Camp David that he hoped he didn't wake up the next morning. He came back Monday morning, and he was aware that we were occupying his business offices and all the business offices. He wasn't happy about it. He came down the hallway. He stopped, and he screamed with his entourage in the background, "This is a disgrace. These men are not criminals. They are not criminals. You shouldn't be here." And then he walked up to one poor FBI agent. He grabbed the agent by the lapels, picked the agent up, and then slammed the agent repeatedly against the door, screaming, "These men are not criminals. They are not criminals." So the agent is, "What's the proper action?" "Well, it's the president. I guess I just take it." So the agent used excellent judgment. He allowed himself to be ridiculed, slammed against the wall, and generally beat up by the president. Okay. Very interestingly, 2 hours later, without the entourage, about 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, agent still on duty in front of that office. Who comes down the hallway by himself? Richard Nixon. By himself, he walks up to the agent, and he sincerely apologizes for his behavior. Sincerely apologizes. So a little different dimension of a man who was really, really tortured. That was one of the kind of spontaneous incidents that happened in this great caper. Any questions? Yeah. I got to come back here because my ears are shot.
Was it the scooter sergeant who found the microphone that led to you getting the call when you're in the shower? Who recognized that it was a federal case? You said it was finding the microphone.
Yeah, finding the microphone. Immediately, that raised suspicions, and we had a couple of agents, one who happened to be on duty in the office at the time, okay, that particular evening, had some knowledge about this particular violation and what you needed within the confines of the statute for it to be our violation. And we called in another agent, Dan Mahan, handsome Dan Mahan, I'd have to say, handsome Dan Mahan, as he billed himself.
My question was, yeah.
That was, well, the police, when they saw the magnitude of the burglary and when they saw how many people were involved, an ex-FBI, CIA agent involved in the case, that sort of thing, and it was the Democratic National Headquarters, they had Minolta cameras in the bag, in the bag where the microphone was. They had rolls of film, and it just was a case generally beyond their capacity, okay, not in terms of talent, but in terms of the overall perspective of it. So they immediately called the FBI. And one thing we do, I say we do, I'm retired now, but one thing the FBI does, we get a lot of calls from different agencies, different citizens, and the police. And what we will do is we will assess a situation and we will always go out and talk to somebody if there's any question about whether we need to be involved at all. We can always be involved on, we have one administrative guiding precept that we use, and that is, and it's written in our rules and regulations, if we are requested by the police or any agency for help, for assistance in a case that they're investigating, we will provide that assistance. So we have that general mandate to involve ourselves to help the police if we are requested, even if we don't have any clear jurisdiction, okay? So we use that fairly often. But in this case, and it was important because if we didn't have that clear jurisdiction, we might have been shut down because you know we were threatened and they did everything they possibly could to thwart us. So that little microphone in the toilet paper, we recognized for what it was and then brought an agent with the expertise. Yes, sir.
Yeah, great. We have, we're at that hour, but we think we can have like three or four more questions. We can
Yes, slightly different from what you did at Watergate, but your experience as in the FBI. Have you come across or heard through word of mouth that the investigations by the FBI have been suppressed or tried to be suppressed by a president or attorney general? And also, if you had heard of any court judges that seemed to go against what the FBI had found?
You mean in just a general sense in other cases and so forth? Yeah. I personally have not, okay? I personally have not. But I wouldn't take my opinion and just use it as a cover for everything that's ever happened in the FBI, because my experience is very limited to what I came into contact with. In this particular case, one of the things that did happen is the Assistant Attorney General, Henry Peterson, for Criminal Affairs, he did inquire of us that first weekend, hey, what's going on? What's happening in this case? So we had to give him a thorough report that first weekend, and that was normal. That wasn't unusual. So the pressure to shut down the case in this particular situation did not come from the Justice Department. It came directly from the president and his men is where it came from, okay? And then I mentioned the leak situation where we were fingered. We were kind of collateral damage there to protect the bosses who were leaking the information. And interesting about the FBI with under Director Hoover, there's a long history and a long tradition of leaking information to the press on a variety of situations when J. Edgar Hoover saw it to his advantage or to the Bureau's advantage to get information out there. Walter Winchell, who used to be a radio broadcaster, a very popular one in New York, Walter Winchell was a favorite source of J. Edgar Hoover's. So there's a long tradition of this in the FBI. Okay?
Now that Hillary Clinton is involved, the FBI is involved with the server and the email situation, can you give us any suggestion, a hint, as how this investigation-wise will go forward?
Oh, you, with Hillary with the emails?
Yeah.
Okay. Got to be really, really careful here in my answer, right? And I'm just saying this from my own personal experience, okay? And this is the way the FBI operates. In a case like this, literally all of the I's and all of the T's will be put in place and dotted. It'll be very, very cautious in what they do. I would suspect that any of the emails which are, say, suspect emails for whatever cause, will be routed to somebody who has the expertise, the ultimate expertise, to render an opinion. That opinion will not, I suspect, be rendered by any FBI agent. I doubt that the expertise is within the Bureau to do that. But the FBI will reach out and will consult experts for opinions and include that in the process. It's a very healthy way, as you can see, to go. One thing I failed to mention, I'll just do it briefly. After I left Washington Field Office, I was angling and I was going to graduate school at night. And I obtained a transfer to the Behavioral Science Unit, the new Behavioral Science Unit at Quantico, which is where I worked for 6.5 years as a staff member and worked on psychological and sociological projects that we had. I worked on hostage negotiation. I worked on crisis intervention, which is the negotiation of the non-criminal role of the police in handling ordinary disputes. And then I crafted and put together a 3-unit course in police stress and personal problems, which was an interest I had because of the experience I had not only in San Francisco, but in contacting other police officers. I found the problem similar and under-addressed. So we began addressing that in the unit there. So I had that experience for 3.5 years. 6.5. Other questions?
I think you answered this, but because you mentioned that J. Edgar Hoover had the habit of leaking, but did any of those officials above you that eventually were identified with leaks, were any consequences? Did they have to feel any consequences of the fact they did this, or was this just the way way things operated?
Yes, only one that I know of, okay? And it's a very minor consequence. Robert Kunkel, who was the agent in charge when the Watergate case began, okay, and who I personally had a lot of respect for, he eventually, rather quickly, was transferred from the Washington Field Office as the SAC, and Jack McDermott, the gentleman I mentioned to you from New York, was brought in as the agent in charge. So something, I don't know what it was, something must have happened with Mr. Krunkel, which he was ousted and sent to an office as SAC, a less prestigious office. That was a common way to deal with what was seen to be as a problem. And, in the FBI, it is very, very easy to find yourself on the wrong end of something you may have said or done. I'll just share one with you very briefly. I'll give you the real shortened version. When I came in the FBI, we could not drink coffee. We were prohibited from drinking any coffee on duty or any place around duty. The reason was because if you were drinking coffee, you couldn't be working, and individuals who were around a coffee cup were seen as being, you know, too lax. Okay, so we could not drink coffee. If you were caught drinking coffee, it was serious. Obviously, all the agents drank coffee and paid no attention to that rule. But if you were caught, there would be a consequence. A couple agents were caught drinking coffee in a public coffee house in Washington, D.C. They were duly punished. Duly punished. One was a real party animal. He loved to party and drink. The other was an outdoorsman. Thank you. The other was an outdoorsman, okay? In punishment, J. Edgar Hoover sent the party animal to New Orleans. Yeah, the outdoorsman was sent to Montana. Some punishment, huh?
Mr. Menderman, it's a great story. Many wonderful details. Tell me, did you keep a journal of this, or are you relying on your memory of such important events?
I kept no journal at all, but it's all from memory. I did do one thing. I did a couple of things. I wrestled with this problem. I said, you know, I really need to talk with Angelo Leno, the case agent. And when I talked to my partner, Paul Magalinas, and Paul is another one of these wonderful characters in the FBI. The FBI of my era was all guys who looked like me. We were a white bread organization, okay? Washington Field, the city of Washington was about maybe 60, 65% black. We had about 350 agents in Washington, D.C. How many black agents did we have? Two. We had two black agents, okay? Paul was Puerto Rican. Paul was outgoing. Paul had jewelry. Paul was a great interviewer. And I called Paul and I said, you know, Paul, I really need to talk to Ange. He says, you know, he's not one of my favorites, John. I said, okay, I understand. I understand, Paul. But I called Ange. Hey, Ange, John. Yeah. I said, this is what I'm doing. You think you can help me with anything? I don't know. I'm on my way to the beach with my family. If I find anything, I'll send it to you. See ya. That was the end of the conversation, so I had no hope at all of anything. About 3-4 weeks later, a large 8.5 by 11 envelope arrives at my residence with 7 typewritten pages of all kinds of things that would help and would fill in gaps, that kind of thing. And he made himself available to answer some questions and that sort of thing. So it's once again the admonition, unless you reach out, unless you try, especially when you don't want to, okay? Especially when you don't want to, when you're hesitant, nothing's going to happen. In this case, it was very positive. So, no, this is all recollection, but you can understand these kinds of experiences you do not forget. And you do not forget the details of what happened.
And we're very glad you didn't.
Well, that's it, yeah. Now, what you should remember is not me. You shouldn't remember me, and you shouldn't remember what the FBI agents did. The one you want to always remember, my heroine, Judy Hoback. Don't ever forget her, Judy Hoback, and her friend Peggy Gleason. These were two real American heroines, okay? Thank you. Beg your pardon?
Do you know where they are today?
I don't know. I hope they're doing well. I don't know. Okay? Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Glad you came. I appreciate it very much. Yeah.
And so ends another lecture at the Commonwealth Club in its 113th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.